hear small things shifting and moving in the corners. It seemed in some horrible way to be an insidious, dark analog of the plant lab on Marfa. Its instruments designed not to foster life, but to inflict and sustain dosages of pain on whatever might still be alive here. There was something rustling in a cage in the shadows, making little smacking noises with its mouth. "Do you have it?" With an involuntary breath of surprise, Zoe turned and looked back. In the center of the lab, a tall man in a dark robe stood watching them, his face a chiseled amalgam of shadow and bone, the cheek structure cruelly sharp, the hollows of his eyes like the sockets of a skull. Zoe felt a thin wire of fear probe downward through her chest and into the pit of her stomach, where it dangled, twitching in the darkness. She thought of the name that Tulka had mentioned on their way here. Darth Scabrous. The Sith Lord was staring at her, his expression inscrutable, although the raw intensity in his stare was unmistakable. It was as if he was looking at something that he wanted simultaneously to possess and to destroy. Without a word, the Whippet took the orchid from Zoe's hand. He walked over to where the Sith Lord stood and held the flower out to him.
"This is it."
Darth Scabrous took the flower, giving it only the most cursory of glances before returning his attention to Zoe. There was a glimmer in his eyes that hadn't been there before. Tulka stood waiting.
"My money," he said.
If the Sith Lord heard him, he showed no sign. He was still staring at Zoe.
"Her name's Hestizo Trace," the Whippet said. "She's the Orchid's keeper. It needs her to...
survive," Scabrous said.
"I know. That's how I knew you were bringing me the genuine article."
He reached up and touched her face, his gloved hand cold against her cheek like leather wrapped around an iron rod.
"It was the one piece of information that I withheld about the orchid."
"Then our business here is finished," Tulka said.
The Sith Lord nodded. "My droid will pay you on the way out."
The Whippet nodded and walked away.
"No,"
Zoe called out after him, watching him go.
"Wait!"
She felt a steel band of panic tighten around her chest, pressing painfully inward, crowding out her breath. She heard his footfalls growing quieter down the long stone corridor, then the faint hydraulic whoosh as the lift doors opened and shut again. Then he was gone. The Sith Lord was still looking at her. A new silence spread out, seeming to fill the lab with a stinging mist of cold, dry air. Zoe was aware, for the first time since they'd landed, of the orchid making anxious noises inside her mind, a soft, irregular click of nervous energy awakening to what might happen next. Although she knew she was the only one who could hear the sounds, she still felt an irrational impulse to hush it.
"You are a Jedi," Scabrous said.
"I am." She braced herself for his contempt, even rage. But the Sith Lord simply nodded as if he'd expected nothing less than her appearance here, had, in fact, anticipated it. He reached out with one hand, not quite touching her, and she felt a certain heaviness underneath her left breast, as if his palm were pushing directly against the muscle of her heart. Then he lowered his hand, and the pressure disappeared. He picked up the flower and carried it across the laboratory to the place where Zoe had heard the soft, lip-smacking noises. What she saw inside made her stomach do a slow, nauseated barrel roll. The teenage boy in the cage was staring up at her with bright, unblinking shoe-button eyes that bespoke nothing less than utter madness. On closer examination, Zoe saw a vine-like tangle of plastic tubes sprouting directly out from the young man's back, where they seemed to have been implanted into his spine and the base of his skull. Thick, yellowish-red fluid crept sluggishly back and forth through the tubing,
Zoe followed the lines across the floor to where they connected to an electronic pump with a large glass cylinder on top. A ghastly kind of circuit had been created here, she realized. A hybrid between human and machine. Scabrous made an adjustment to the pump. The fluid in the tubes moved faster. The boy went rigid and then began pounding his face against the cage over and over with a terrible kind of rhythmic intensity. The cage clanged with the crush of impact until the boy's face began to ooze blood, trickling scarlet from his nostrils and lips and the corners of his eyes. Still, the boy did not stop. He was beating himself senseless, Zoe realized, trying to knock himself unconscious or perhaps simply to kill himself, ending whatever torment was yet to come. Stop! Zoe stared back at Scabrous. What is this? Watch and see. What are you doing to him? Scabrous didn't answer. A moment later, he opened the top of the cylinder of reddish-yellow fluid and dropped the orchid inside. Jura, Ostrogoth, witnessed the whole thing. He'd slipped inside the tower when the Whippet had stepped out, not giving himself time to deliberate. Experience had taught him that such opportunities ought not to be wasted, and so he had gone. Ever since Nictor's disappearance the previous day, the Academy's rumor mill had been humming along at light speed about Darth Scabrous and what might be going on up in his lab. Earlier this morning, Jura had overheard Purgus Frode, a technician at the Academy's hangar, telling one of the other masters that Scabrous had had visitors, two bounty hunters who hadn't returned to their ship last night. And now Kindra had told Jura that she'd seen two more off-worlders, a Whippet and a girl, heading into the tower. They were carrying something with them, Kindra said. Nobody knew what. It was only a matter of time until someone came out. After lightsaber training, Jura had gone off by himself and crouched down underneath the snow-encrusted stones of a half-collapsed ruin facing the tower's main entrance. The cold hadn't bothered him in the least. It had given him time to think, to clear his head. He had already decided that he wasn't going to spend his life worrying about being exposed by Skopeek. If he was going to escape from underneath Skopeek's thumb, he needed to change the game. Of course, he couldn't counterattack now, having just cornered him. Skopeek would be expecting retribution. But once Jura found out what was happening inside the tower, he decided he would arrange a private meeting with the Zabrak. He would tell Skopeek everything, confide in him, gain his trust. And when Skopeek was off guard, gloating, Jura would... what? Kill him? Maybe. Or perhaps just humiliate him, the way that Skopeek had humiliated Jura. In any case, things were about to be very different. How different? Jura could never have guessed 20 minutes earlier, as he had slipped out of the turbolift and made his way across the open laboratory at the top of the tower. Candles and torches dotted the room with flickering intermittent light. He'd been worried that he might be heard. The lift was hardly silent. But even before the doors opened, he'd heard someone screaming and a metallic crashing noise. The sound bounced off the windows and stone ceiling, blocking out everything else. Jura slunk through pools of shadow, making his way between the clusters of equipment until he could make out the unmistakable shape of Lord Scabrous and someone else, a girl, standing next to what looked like a caged animal, the source of the crashing and the screaming. Jura stopped again, narrowed his eyes, looked more closely. The caged animal was Nictor. Nictor was thrashing in his little prison, shrieking and writhing and blubbering out noises that sounded only slightly like words. There was blood running down his face, sticking and clinging to his cheeks as if he'd been sitting under a melting red candle.
He was half-naked, his exposed torso gleaming with sweat. But the worst were the tubes. They ran directly out of his back, long, pipe-like conduits from his spine, leading to a machine with a large, transparent cylinder mounted on top. Scabrous was doing something to the machine, holding up some object that Jura couldn't identify, putting it inside the cylinder. The fluid inside it began roiling, changed color, became suddenly remarkably incandescent, pulsing through the tubes into Nictor's vertebrae. The screaming stopped. Jura watched Nictor collapse to the floor of the cage, motionless and silent, mouth half open, eyelids sagging. Now the only sound was the high, steady drone of a heart monitor in flatline. Jura let out the breath that he'd been holding in his lungs for the last 10 seconds. He didn't need to get any closer to see that Wim Nictor was dead. Zoe stared at the dead Sith student in the cage. His eyes were still open, glassy and lifeless. His mouth sagged, a bloody spit bubble clinging to the corner. A waxy pallor had already begun to spread over his cheeks, turning his skin a pale shade of gray. In her mind, the orchid was still screaming. She couldn't move, couldn't think. Nothing in her experience at the Marfa facility or before had prepared her for this. In the past 48 standard hours, the routines of her daily existence had become a blood-soaked travesty of reality. Her eyes flashed up to the glass cylinder where Scabrous had dropped the flower. It wasn't there anymore. The fluid seemed to have absorbed it, dissolving it in chunks. But she could still hear it. Wherever it had gone, whatever had happened to it, crying out, begging her to do something, to help it to stop the pain. Burning. Zoe, it's burning. It's burning. Scabrous was watching the cylinder. In the cage, the dead boy sat up.
Chapter 13, Dragon Teeth.
Jura never saw the door blow off the cage. It happened so quickly that the only thing his mind registered was the wire mesh flying across the lab, slamming into a vented power cell housing that protruded down from the ceiling. Metal struck metal with a flat, declarative clang that reminded him somehow of the sound of training blades clashing at the top of the temple. It was a noise that said, things have been put into motion, and whatever happens next, there will be no going back. From his hiding place, Jura stared, crouched in the shadows as if welded to the spot. He saw Scabrous and the girl staring at the cage, neither one of them moving. The thing that crawled out of the cage wasn't Wim Nictor. It was draped in Nictor's skin, yes, and it wore some version of Nictor's face. But the eyes were ovals of smeared glass behind which pupils darted back and forth in the torchlight, like tiny black insects trapped inside a dirty bottle. It cranked its head to the right, and the yellow grin that wrinkled its lips back was unlike anything Jura had ever seen. Watching it, he felt himself melting inside, a breathless terror invading him, stripping away strength, reducing him to a shuddering pool of nerves. The intuitive voice of the Force was shouting at him now, wrong, wrong, wrong. But he couldn't seem to move. The Sith Lord gazed upon his creation. A terrible, prescient smile crept across his face. Nictor, he said, come to me. The thing shuffled another step forward, and Scabrous held out one hand, beckoning it forth like an animal. Yes, that's right. All at once, Nictor sprang forward with an entirely different kind of urgency, the tubes ripping out of its back, flailing free, leaving a row of raw-looking opened wounds down its spine. Reddish-yellow stuff splashed and spewed from the open tubes, spraying out into the air. From his hiding place, Jura saw the Sith Lord rear backward, his arms in front of his face, as the thing that had once been Wim Nictor landed on top of him and without hesitation sank its teeth into Scabrous's face. Scabrous swung one arm upward and the thing flew back across the lab, its body reduced to a momentary blur, flailing into a tall rack of unused flasks and beakers not far from where Jura was still crouched. The rack exploded in a deafening cacophony of shattered glass, the thing tumbling over the floor, and Jura saw it push itself upright, its cheeks and forehead glittering with broken shards like dragon teeth. Astringent smells of alcohol and ammonia and carbolic acid filled the air. Jura saw the girl stand up and run for the turbo lift. She never looked back, not even as the doors sealed shut behind her. A roar of fury shook the chamber around him, loud enough that Jura felt it reverberating in the hollow of his chest. On the opposite side of the lab, Scabrous rose up. The right half of his face hung down in a pale, bloody flap. Above it, his eyes coruscated with anger so ferocious that it looked like something entirely different, something dangerously close to madness. The Sith Lord flung out his right hand, palm raised in the direction of Nictor's corpse. The corpse jerked back again, tumbling like a thing on wires, and this time Jura Ostrogoth realized that he was the one crouched directly in its path. The realization came too late to save him. Nictor's corpse collided with him, knocking him off his feet and pounding the air out of his lungs, hurling both of them backward into one of the wide, curved viewports that formed the tower's wall. Jura's final impression, that the entire world was bursting apart around him in a brittle, deafening explosion, was not altogether wrong. Then he fell. Chapter 14, Dropouts. Lusk? Rance Lusk stopped walking, paused a moment, and turned around. He had been on his way to the Academy's library for an afternoon of solitary meditation and study when the voice piped up behind him. It was Ra'at. The smaller, wiry-framed apprentice stood with both hands behind his back, gazing at him defiantly through the veil of falling snow. He looked radically different from the last time Lusk had seen him. Something changed in his posture, his bearing, the way he held his shoulders. Even his voice was bolder, more direct and confrontational. His eyes were polished stones, filled with a new and willful sense of determination. "What do you want? You weren't at lightsaber practice this morning?" Lusk didn't even bother to shrug, communicating his indifference solely through lack of expression. Everyone at the Academy knew that he only attended training sessions when he felt like it, when he wanted to test himself or prove a point to one of the masters. He took a step closer to Ra'at. They were alone here behind the library's immense sprawl. The Academy's masters and students otherwise engaged in training or the rigors of midday study. Above them, the tower stood, its shadow banded across the walkway like premature twilight. And it occurred to Lusk that this, too, might have been deliberate on Ra'at's part. Perhaps he had hoped Lord Scabrous might happen to be looking down. "Well, what is it?" Ra'at brought his hands out from behind his back, revealing what Lusk had already guessed would be there. A pair of training lightsabers glinting in the gray afternoon light. "Does Blademaster Shockwith know that you ran off with two of his toys?" Lusk asked. Ra'at didn't smile. The intensity of his expression never wavered. "I challenge you." Cocking an incredulous eyebrow, Lusk asked, "Now?" "Now." For an instant, certainly no longer, Lusk almost considered it. Then he shook his head. "You don't want to do that." "What are you afraid of?" "From you?" Lusk blinked lackadaisically. "Boredom, for a start." "Then I'll be sure not to bore you," Ra'at said, and tossed one of the blades in Lusk's direction. Lusk caught it on reflex, but lowered it to his side. "I'm busy right now," he said. "If you're determined to humiliate yourself, you'll have to do it publicly in front of the..." "Masters" had been the last word of that sentence, but Lusk didn't get a chance to say it before Ra'at jumped at him, his feet hardly seeming to touch the ground. As opening salvos went, it was brutal but effective. A move whose grace would have been easier to admire if it hadn't ended with Ra'at's blade thwacking him across the chest, raising a hot streak of pain just below his collarbone. Lusk spun back, blade up, aware now that he was in this whether he wanted to be or not. And with Ra'at, he realized it wouldn't be as simple as flattening him. An example would need to be made, or else every student would be out here trying him. More than anything, Lusk felt a kind of exasperation. Hadn't Nictor been enough of a lesson? Was Ra'at suicidal or simply insane? He dived forward with his own blade, tense for impact, but Ra'at wasn't where he'd been just a second before, seeming almost to have vanished in a cloud of snow. Lusk looked up. The other apprentice was somersaulting directly over him, spiraling down. And Lusk's instincts flung him out of the way a split second before Ra'at landed. "Your Ataru has improved," Lusk grunted. "You've been practicing." Pivoting hard, he brought his own blade around where he predicted Ra'at would be, and this time he was right. When Ra'at looked up, he found himself facing the tip of Lusk's blade. One stroke would finish the duel. Two would kill him. But there was another option. "Now," Lusk said, meeting the other apprentice's stare and letting the force flow through him like an electric current, "drop your blade." Ra'at held his mouth taut until the tendons stood out in his jaw. His arm quivered, but he didn't release the blade. "Drop your blade," Lusk repeated. Still, Ra'at didn't move. Lusk felt real anger taking hold of him, the kind of rage he rarely experienced. Without hesitation, he thrust his own blade at his opponent. If Ra'at was so determined to die like this out here behind the library, then Lusk would oblige him. As he swung forward, he heard a window shatter overhead. Looking up, he saw something explode out of the top of the tower, momentarily arrayed in a glinting halo of broken glass. At first, Lusk thought it was some kind of alien species. It had too many arms and legs. Then he realized he was actually seeing two people, one wrapped around the other. The drop from the tower had to be 100 meters or more. They fell together, twisting midair, plummeting downward, slamming into the rocky, snow-covered walkway with a sickening, meaty crunch. Despite his reputation for toughness, Lusk had to look away. Gravity had made a meal of the corpses, contorting them into unfamiliar shapes. Broken bones punctured the flesh. One of them, a shirtless, blood-smeared sack of leaking viscera, lay at such an angle that Lusk could see its right eye protruding from a socket. Then it sat up. Lusk gaped at it, paralyzed by a dozy wave of perfect awe. "That's impossible," he thought. "Nobody survives a fall like that. Nobody." His thought, whatever was left of it, broke off cleanly. The blood-smeared one was looking straight at him with its one good eye, a savage, inhuman smirk swimming over what remained of its face. Besides knocking the eye out, the fall had done something to its spine and shoulders, wrenched them around sideways, jamming the clavicles outward, shoving the bone of his arm up through the skin. It looked like a suit of flesh-colored clothes that had been recklessly draped on its hanger. Yet it was still moving. Its broken arms grabbed the other corpse, scooping it up in one flopping, eager gesture and raked it toward its mouth. And that was when Lusk realized that behind the broken bones and layers of blood, he was looking at the mangled bodies of Wim Nictor and Jura Ostrogoth. The thing that had been Nictor bobbed its head and buried its teeth in the pulpy remains of Ostrogoth's face. Almost immediately, Lusk could hear the noises, a series of greedy, slobbering grunts. Ostrogoth, what was left of him, made no move to resist. "What is that?" Rath's voice was murmuring behind him. "What is that thing?" Lusk shook his head, stepping back. He had no idea what he'd just seen. This would all take time to process, to decide how he was going to fight it or use it to his own advantage. But for the moment, he'd take it on its own terms.
"You figure it out."
Tossing his blade aside, Lusk turned on Ra'at and grabbed the smaller apprentice by the tunic with both hands, yanking him forward hard enough to snap Ra'at's teeth together like castanets. Ra'at's shock had left him vulnerable, an easy target. Ra'at's own blade slipped from his hand, clanking off rocks before it stuck in the new-fallen snow.
"Wait! What are you doing?" Ra'at asked. "You can't..."
Lusk spun him around and shoved him backward as hard as possible in the direction of the slobbering, eating thing that was crouched over Jura Ostrogoth. Ra'at squealed, arms pinwheeling as if something in the air could hold him up. Almost immediately, his feet tangled beneath him and he stumbled, staggered, slid, and finally fell, landing first on his knees, then on his back. The Nictor thing lifted its head. Fresh blood drizzled from its jaw, dripping off its lips. Its one functional eye shivered like a raw egg in a cup. It thrust Jura's corpse aside and devoted its full attention to Ra'at with the appetite of a creature being offered live meat.
"No!"
Ra'at was saying, scrambling upward, or trying to.
"No! No!"
Lusk turned away, legs already tense to run. The last thing he heard the moment before he bolted into the library was Ra'at's scream.
Chapter 15, Triage.
It took Scabrous less than 30 seconds to flush the wound on his face with saline, start an IV on himself, and activate the auto-diagnosis cuff. Everything was exactly where he'd left it. He worked steadily, without the slightest hesitation, the swift and practiced smoothness of his movements betraying none of the anger that sat in his chest like a scalding red lump of coal. There was a faint electronic beep from his right wrist, denoting the 30-second mark. He checked the cuff's glowing blue readout and saw that it was still calibrating the initial blood sample. Meanwhile, the girl, the Jedi scum, was already gone. Scabrous hadn't seen her leave, but he'd known, of course, that she would try to flee the second she got the chance. That was a given. No matter. The Orchid had done its job, and there would be plenty of time to catch up with the Jedi later. She would serve her purpose well enough when the time came. At the moment, he had more pressing matters to attend to. He continued working, holding his emotions carefully in check. Critical thinking was what had gotten him this far with the project. His mind was an engine of clinical detachment and an absolute unwavering commitment to do whatever was necessary to make the experiment a success. The emotions that fueled that engine, ambition, boundless rage, a natural depraved indifference toward anything except himself, lay carefully insulated in the dark vessels of his heart, where they would not be permitted to distract him from his goal. And yet, all the same, he hated her. Hated her with the brutal, grinding hate of the entire Sith war machine. Hated her with the blazing intensity of 10,000 dying suns, this Jedi whose Orchid was the linchpin upon which everything would revolve and whose very presence here would allow him to see the project through to fruition. And it was good to know that hate was there, where he could access it whenever he wanted, like a fine wine to be decanted and sipped sparingly. It would be good to find her and to... well, to finish things. Hestizo Trace would die screaming, and he would live forever. The 1 minute mark. Scabrous flicked his eye down to the auto-analysis unit. The blue numbers pulsed red. He frowned. Just a little. Initial contamination levels were higher than expected. Peaks and waves that the system was already re-diagnosing in order to isolate the specific antigen and lay the groundwork for the next step. He couldn't afford to wait any longer. The hemodialysis pump was portable by design, a flat shoulder pack that held 6 liters of fresh blood and a vacuum tube system. Sliding the straps over his shoulder, Scabrous attached the pump to the IV in his right arm and started the first infusion. A steady feeling of warmth crept up through his arm, filling his chest, loosening the tension, allowing him to breathe more deeply. He set the counters. At the current rate, the blood supply would last Tim 6 hours, assuming things didn't change dramatically in the meantime.
Scabrous bypassed the turbo lift, crossing directly toward the shattered window, casting his gaze out at the broken, snow-stricken terrain spreading out into the horizon.
A feeling of confidence stirred within him, bringing with it a renewed sense of purpose. This was his academy, his planet. Nobody knew it as well as he did. There was nowhere that the Jedi could hide that he could not find her. Without a moment's hesitation, he sprang forward and jumped out the broken viewport. He cleared it easily, plunging out into the night, knifing downward through the air, using the Force to guide his descent 100 meters down. At the base of the tower, he hit the ground running. His mind was humming now, his body inhaling doses of fresh blood, sucking it down like pure oxygen, feeding muscle and brain. Activating his comlink, he brought it to his ear and waited for the voice on the other end to respond.
Query? Yes, my lord?
Activate all outer perimeter barriers in all quadrants, Scabrous told it. Target is Hestizo Trace, the Jedi. Scan the lab for DNA and pheromone sample. He paused, but only for a second, the wind blasting over him. Use whatever means necessary, but I want her alive.
Chapter 16. Convocation.
Hestizo?
Zoe was still running when the orchid's voice rang through her head. It was enough of a surprise that she faltered, almost halting in her tracks. She hadn't stopped moving since she'd left the tower's turbolift. Whether that was 10 minutes ago or half an hour, she didn't know. Time had become wildly subjective, a crazed and illogical sprawl, much like the landscape of the academy itself. Sprinting down between the gray, partially collapsed buildings and ruined temples, she'd focused on putting as much distance as possible between herself and the tower. But every time she looked back, the tower seemed to be in a different place. Her head was swimming. She'd tried not to think about what had happened up there, but those thoughts kept seeping through her defenses like a cut that wouldn't stop bleeding. She saw the face of the boy. Was it a boy? As he'd crawled out of the cage and jumped at Scabrous? The way he'd smelled, the noise that he'd made. He'd been like an animal, but far worse. Hestizo, the orchid's voice cut in. Stop. Stay. Crouch. Zoe looked around. She was standing in front of an enormous statue of some ancient Sith lord that had fallen over on its side, so that the right half of its features had been worn smooth, abraded by decades of wind and snow. Sinking to her knees, she heard other voices, several of them talking among themselves from the far side of the monument. She peered over. A group of students was making their way down a walkway 20 meters in front of her. An older man, a master, she presumed, strode in front of them. His long gray hair was pulled back from his face in a single silver braid, accentuating the angular, hawk-like structure of his nose and forehead. The late afternoon light threw his shadow straight ahead across the crisp, freshly fallen snow, the black outline of his robe making it look as though he had wings.
How many? The orchid murmured in her mind. How many, Hestizo?
She counted 12, 18, 24, and then looked again across a hillock of rock and ice, where a second, much larger group of students had gathered with two or three other masters in attendance, the group too large to count. Apparently, some kind of outdoor assembly or group meditation was in progress. For a moment, Zoe just watched. Despite the fact that they walked together, some of them even talking among themselves in low voices, she had never seen a group of individuals so utterly detached from one another. When they exchanged glances, she saw only coldness in their eyes, as if they were sizing one another up, trying to find some advantage over the others.
Attention!
The master's voice was flinty and sharp, one hand upheld.
Silence!
The students down on the other side of the walkway fell silent, many of them drawing in closer to listen.
For those of you who just arrived, I will explain this only once.
The words were strident, rising up effortlessly over the windy terrain.
Although in truth, I shouldn't have to explain it at all. Your own force sensitivity ought to be sufficient for you to realize that we're dealing with an unforeseen development at the Academy. A train of events that, at this point, is still unclear.
He squared his shoulders and faced the group.
Most of you have already detected a disturbance in the normal daily routine. At this point, we suspect that the Academy has been targeted by some form of sabotage, and that it may have spread outward from the tower.
Despite herself, Zoe found herself listening, and as she did, she realized that the group of students had grown. Now, there appeared to be several hundred of them, perhaps the majority of the entire student body, all looking up in the master's direction.
As a precaution, we are suspending all lessons and drills until further notice. Evening meal will be served as usual. Otherwise, you are to return to your dorms for private study and await further instructions. One of the masters will be in contact when our course of action changes.
Zoe realized as she listened that she could hear a slight but unmistakable tremor of concern in the master's tone. He was doing everything he could to cover it up, and perhaps the students were fooled. But to her mind, he might as well have been wearing a placard.
I'm doing my best to spin a situation that I have absolutely no ability to comprehend, let alone control, and...
Hestizo!
The orchid's voice was urgent, alarmed.
Get down, now!
She turned her head to the right and realized that one of the students at the edge of the group was staring straight at her. The student's name was Ranlaw. Like the rest of his classmates, he'd been feeling increasingly jumpy this entire afternoon, and he didn't know precisely why. It had affected his sparring performance earlier, and he was still angry about the black eye it had cost him. But something had gone wrong here at the Academy. The Force was telling him to watch his back, and the Masters calling them to convocation only affirmed it. When he saw the girl looking at him from behind the statue, he'd stopped walking and gazed back at her, sensing that she had something to do with it. She's a Jedi. That realization was all it took. Ranlaw felt a bright spark of violence leap up in his chest. Whatever purpose the Jedi girl had for spying on them, he'd drag her to the Masters himself, and they could beat it out of her. The rest of the group was listening to Master Tra'an, no one noticing that Ranlaw had been looking the other way. That was fine with Ranlaw, who fully intended to get all the glory of this discovery. In a single leap, he sprang up over the fallen statue, tackling the girl and throwing her to the ground, pinning her by the wrists. She was easy prey, almost too easy.
"What's your business here, Jedi?"
She glared up at him, breathless and furious.
"Let me go."
"Right."
Taking one hand off her wrist, he grabbed her hair and jerked her upright.
Let's see what the masters have to say about you.
Randlaw rose to his feet, dragging her with him, and took in a breath to call down to the others. He was still in the process of inhaling when a clawed hand clamped down over his lips, silencing him. Randlaw tried to squirm free, and the back of a wooden spear slammed down across the top of his skull with a sharp crack, dropping him sideways.
Zoe saw the Sith student tumble forward, his grip falling slack, releasing her hair as she fell. In the place where he'd been hunched over, she saw a great three-fingered hand gripping her shoulder and forcing her back down out of sight, and she realized she was looking at Tolka. His shoulders were arched enough that she could see the quiver of arrows strapped to his back. Spinning the spear easily around, the Whippet raised the business end again, swung it around, and thrust its point directly in Zoe's face, close enough that she could feel it pressing against her cheek. All this was accomplished in absolute silence. What are you doing? Tolka didn't budge. His expression was stone.
There's something I need to show you.
I don't...
Move.
Chapter 17. Nettie.
Nettie.
The library was silent. To her knowledge, Kindra was the only student in the academy who came here on any kind of a regular basis. Without exception, it was the largest and oldest structure on Odacer Faustin, predating the tower itself, which also meant that it was in the worst condition. Centuries of hostile weather and shifting planetary tectonics had savaged its stacks, closing off entire chambers, stairways, and corridors under tons of snow and ice. From within, it resembled nothing so much as a grand monument that had suffered a head-on collision with something even bigger than itself, crumpling it badly at both ends and the middle. She sat in the southwest wing, at one of the long stone tables under the cracked cathedral ceiling, staring at the most recent sections of Sith scrolls that she'd uncovered. The inscriptions were archaic, and she'd been working most of the afternoon on translating them. The process was slow but gratifying, yielding ancient secrets that she knew would only help her advance faster through the ranks of her fellow students. There were rumors that Darth Scabrous himself had come here, that he had found something, a relic of almost immeasurable power hidden in one of the secluded rooms. Whether that was true, an object like a Sith holocron wasn't outside the realm of possibility. Kindra had already found enough to make her research here worthwhile. She paused, her index finger marking a spot halfway through a long intaglio of etchings, and cocked her head slightly. Something was wrong. It wasn't as obvious as a noise or even a vibration, more like an intuitive sensation of disquiet that settled into her stomach and emanated out through her chest, as if millions of tiny cilia had extended from within her, shivering with unease. She stood up, the scrolls forgotten.
Who's there?
Her voice rang out in the emptiness, hollow and fading into silence. There was no reply, and a moment later she realized that she hadn't truly expected one. It wasn't that kind of feeling. It was more abstract, like a suddenly remembered nightmare whose full contents she couldn't quite summon up. What is that? What's happening? She drew a shaky breath, not comprehending this inexplicable mutiny of her nervous system. Studying to be a Sith warrior was about engendering fear in others, not oneself. Yet her palms had begun to sweat and her heart was beating twice as hard as it normally did. All at once, she wanted to be out of here, in less confined quarters. She looked back at the tall staircase leading upward to the gallery and the concourse beyond it, the one that would lead her out.
She stuffed her notes into her bag, grabbed her cloak, and turned to go. From above her, the broken ceiling let out a long, creaking noise, and when she looked up, she saw one of those cracks splitting wider.
"Who is it?" she said louder. "Who's there?"
Now the chasms had spread open enough that she could see something stretching out inside them, uncoiling in the ceiling's depths to expose a series of long, clutching branches. They forked downward, snake-like, showering bits of grit and rock as they insinuated farther through open space. A moment later, Kendra saw the great wooden face of the librarian, Annette, staring down at her. "Daleless?" she swallowed, managing to find her voice. "What do you want?"
"Something unsettling you, Kendra?"
His voice was thick and raspy.
"Some uncertainty of the mind, Jess?"
"No." The librarian didn't respond, just continued to slither his branches downward until the great bulk of his trunk dangled upside down in front of her, the warty, centuries-old eyes narrowing with myopic consideration. Dale Liss had been the curator of the library for as long as anyone could remember, perhaps going back 1,000 years or more. Although his elaborate root system was permanently embedded somewhere deep in the foundation, a seemingly endless network of branches and limbs allowed him to slide unimpeded through its walls and hollows. Ironically, it was this constant writhing and squirming that undermined the infrastructure of the building itself. Rumor was that it would only be a matter of time before the Netty brought the library down on top of him, sealing himself forever amid his own precious holdings. A fitting enough end, when Kendra thought about it.
"Feel it, too, I do," he said at last. "Yes, yes."
"I didn't say..." A branch grazed down past her face, fussing over the pile of scrolls, straightening and brushing off the ones that she'd left out.
"Didn't have to say anything. Written all over your face, Jess."
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"Talking about the sickness out there in the wind?"
That brought her up short. "What?"
"In the wind," the Netty repeated. "Disease. Taste it. Feel it. Don't you?"
Kendra didn't want to linger here. A long, cryptic conversation with a tree was the last thing she was interested in at the moment. But she realized the Netty had perfectly encapsulated her own feeling of unease. There was a sickness in the wind, some type of disease, and she could feel it. Under such circumstances, the direct approach seemed best. "Do you know what it is?" she asked.
"Ought not to venture out,"
the Netty said, his branches clutching at the scrolls, beginning to roll them up with slow, deliberate movements.
"Safer here, Jess."
"If there's trouble, I can handle it."
"Not this kind. No, don't think so."
"Look." Kendra shook her head, increasingly irritated by the librarian's evasiveness. "Either you have answers for me or you don't. Either way, I'm not going to stay in here and hide."
"Best course of action, I would say."
She pointed at the scrolls. "Leave those out for me. I'll be back for them later. Understand?"
"I think it is you, Kendra, who does not understand."
She shook her head. "Whatever." The Netty didn't argue, didn't say a word.
only gazed upon her with his sorrowful wooden stare as she mounted the steps and headed out.
Chapter 18. Just another day in paradise.
Paradise.
Ra'at opened his eyes slowly, as if afraid of what he might find. He didn't know how long he'd been sprawled out here unconscious at the bottom of the rock pile under the tower, but it was almost dark now, so several hours might have passed. A fine layer of snow had accumulated in the folds of his clothes.
He was so cold that he almost couldn't feel it anymore, although the pain might have had something to do with that.
His right arm throbbed terribly just below the shoulder. Touching it, running his hand under the torn sleeve, he drew back with a hiss. Live wires of raw tendon seared and shivered just beneath the skin. He probed again, more gingerly. The gash was deep, almost to the bone. He tried to lift his arm and discovered that it was virtually useless. The left one worked better, but his entire right side ached so badly when he moved that it wouldn't do him much good in a fight. Almost as bad, he had a sick disequilibrium in his stomach, like a heavy sandbag swinging back and forth at the end of a rope. Due to a concussion, maybe. He wondered how hard he'd smacked his head when he'd fallen. In an attempt to get reoriented, he cast his mind back to what had happened. The details of the attack rose reluctantly into his memory, like debris bobbing up from an underwater explosion, and after a moment he recalled it in detail. The thing that had fallen from the tower, the thing that had once been Wim Nictor. The other corpse, Jura Ostrogoth, was nowhere to be found. Ra'at wondered now with a sickish curiosity if maybe the Nictor thing might have eaten it. Whatever the case, he had never fought anything like Nictor's corpse.
Its eye, dead and flat, but gleaming with fierce hunger. Mouth open so wide that it had actually started splitting at the corners.
In extremis, Ra'at's logical mind had bypassed the whole question of credibility. Disbelief wouldn't help him here. It would only slow him down, so he'd taken it at face value. Apparently, dead bodies were coming back to life, and this one wanted to eat him.
He remembered how the Nictor thing had shrieked when it had first lunged at him, how he had reacted automatically, springing out of the way, using the same accentuated force skills he'd been developing in Harrakhan's pain bunker.
Up in the air, he'd grabbed hold of the overhanging rock slab of the structure behind him and swung himself on top of it, only then daring to look down. Using the resourcefulness that he'd been taught as part of his training, Ra'at had grabbed the biggest chunk of loose stone that he could lift. It must have weighed as much as he did, and flung it over the edge. It was a direct hit, knocking the Nictor thing back down to the ground, where it immediately shoved the stone away and started to climb again. If anything, it was clambering up faster, driven forward by unmistakable appetite. Already, Ra'at realized he couldn't stay up here indefinitely. He needed a better plan. Glancing around behind him, he spotted an even larger pile of rocks, the remains of a second level that had collapsed long before. He'd worked quickly but carefully, piling the slabs up, scraping his fingers and knuckles along the way until he had a tall, precarious stack that was staying upright only because he was holding onto it. Summoning the force, Ra'at had focused it on the pile and removed his hands. The rocks teetered but did not fall. Looking around, he saw the Nictor thing dragging itself up onto the overhang, its eye locked hungrily on Ra'at. "Come on, then," Ra'at said, taking a single step away. Nictor charged, and Ra'at let the stones fall, slamming down on the corpse's leg just below the knee, pinning it there. The thing jerked and spasmed and screamed at him until Ra'at picked up another rock, using his hands again, and swung it down hard on Nictor's neck. There was a surprisingly loud and deeply satisfying crunch as its cervical spine shattered and the thing went limp. Taking no chances, Ra'at hoisted the rock a second time, intending to beat the thing's skull in with it. And that was when it jerked back to life, lashing out at him, hissing and screeching, coming within centimeters of biting his wrist. Jerking backward, Ra'at had lost his footing and plummeted backward off the overhang. After that, everything had gone black. Now, rubbing the back of his head, he wondered if the thing might still be on top of the overhang, crouched in the dark, waiting for him. He had no intention of finding out. What he needed now, more than anything else, was a trip to the infirmary where he could get the cut on his arm cleaned and treated, and get his concussion checked out. A fleeting thought, "What if it's too late?" shot through his mind, and Ra'at shoved it aside, determined now more than ever to keep his wits about him. He knew a little bit about medicine, knew that the odds of herniating one's brain from a simple closed head injury were very long. Anyway, he certainly hadn't spent years here training and working to die from something like this. Clutching his arm, he began walking around the outer rim of the library's west wall. The pain wasn't as bad now as it had been just a few minutes earlier. Either his endorphins were kicking in, numbing the wound, or he was just getting used to it. He walked past the library, occasionally glancing up at the tower where the lights were on at the very top. A scratching sound came from somewhere off to his right, and he stopped and held his breath. "Whoever's there, come out where I can see you." The figure stepped out, a dark-haired girl in an academy uniform. It was Kendra, he saw, one of the female students, maybe a year or two older than he was. "Ra'at," she frowned. "What happened to you?" "I'm fine." She took a step toward him. "You're covered in blood." "It's not as bad as it looks. That cut on your arm. Stay back." "Whatever you say." Kendra's expression sharpened from bewilderment to active suspicion. But she didn't say anything, instead glancing right and left, head tilted, as if listening to the rest of the area. Ra'at found himself listening more actively, too. Within the last few moments, the darkness had thickened around them, taking on additional depth and dimension. And the thin haze of light that escaped from inside the cracks in the library's walls was hardly a sufficient remedy. Ra'at's nauseated belly gave a queasy, volcanic shift, and this time it was followed by a moment of imbalance so sudden that he almost fell over. He had no idea whether Kendra noticed it or not, but he realized now that he could use her, at least until they got to the infirmary, as a kind of insurance policy. She wouldn't fight to defend him, but together they might stand a better chance against whatever was out there. He would just have to be careful not to reveal how weak he truly was, and that meant coming up with a cover story to explain his injury. "I was, working out with Master Harakan," he said. "I guess things got a little out of control. I got my bell rung, that's all." Kendra raised one eyebrow but still didn't respond. "Where is everybody?" "Around." He shrugged, trying to act casual. "I don't know." "You sure you're..." "I'm fine," he repeated. "But Harakan told me I should go to the infirmary and get checked out. You headed that way?" She shook her head, seeming preoccupied. "I'm going back to the dorm." Craning her neck, she looked all the way up to the top of the tower until Ra'at wondered if she might actually have seen the two bodies come spilling outward earlier and was putting the pieces together about what had really happened to his arm and his head. But in the end, all she said was, "Something's wrong."
"Meaning what?"
"I've got a bad feeling." It was an odd remark, he thought, uncharacteristically revealing, and not the sort of thing she'd ever shared with him before. They'd never really had any reason to talk. Immediately, Ra'at suspected that she was trying to gain his trust, to make him let his guard down.
"About what?"
"I don't know. This night. Everything. You feel it?"
"Nope."
He shook his head, feigning an indifference that he didn't even remotely feel.
Just another day in paradise, as far as I'm concerned.
She didn't smile, didn't even seem to hear him. When the wind blew the hair back from her face, Ra'at saw that the corners of her mouth were pinched in a grimace.
What's wrong?
Whatever it is, she still didn't look at him. It's coming.
Chapter 19. Header. On the other side of the academy, fresh snow had begun drifting up outside the dormitory where Skopik had recently returned from his afternoon workout. The Zabrak had just finished his shower. It was his routine to wash up at this time of the day, when he had a rare moment of privacy, and was stepping out of the foggy stall with a towel wrapped around his waist, when he noticed a trail of blood across the floor. He stopped and looked down at it. The blood hadn't been there a moment before when he'd gotten into the shower. The splatters were fresh and bright, streaking across the floor in the direction of the bunks. Skopik felt his defense mechanisms tensing, going into a state of vigilant readiness, his natural aggression already ramping up to the next level. Easing his way silently the rest of the way out of the shower, he dressed quickly in his uniform and followed the blood trail to the right. He could smell something now, the rancid odor of meat that had started to decay. It seemed to be growing worse with every second. That was when he saw the body lying on his bunk. It was dressed in a tattered academy uniform, its limbs and back contorted at unnatural angles so that the head lolled sideways from the obviously broken neck. Staring at it, Skopik murmured a whispered childhood curse in his native language. The possibility that this might be a trick, some kind of poorly conceived prank, never crossed his mind. Someone had beaten a Sith Academy student to death and abandoned the corpse here on his bunk as a warning or threat. He didn't know which. He edged closer, hoping he might be able to recognize the victim from what remained of its face. There wasn't much left to identify. The skull was badly crushed, half the face swollen and purple, the other half grotesquely pancake so that one corner of the mouth peeled upward in a hideous parody of a smile. Skopik took another step, leaning forward, reaching down to turn the head over. The corpse swung itself up and lunged at him. It was Jura Ostrogoth. Skopik sprang back, instincts taking over as the thing charged at him in a ragged, flopping blur. He flew across the dorm floor, then forceleapt straight up, grabbing the ventilation fixture that hung 5 meters above the beds, legs dangling, using the vent's beveled surface for purchase while he scanned the room below for any kind of weapon. Below, the corpse snarled and lunged at him, every leap taking it closer to where Skopik hung on. Thick, ropey spit swung from the half-pulverized jaw. From above, the Zabrak thought he could actually see colonies of maggots squirming in the thing's lacerated scalp. No doubt about it. Death had come for Jura Ostrogoth, but it hadn't finished the job. The Zabrak stared down at the corpse, heart-pounding, killing instincts, fully engaged. On some level, from that first moment when he'd made the tape of Jura on his bunk, he'd known there would be an hour of reckoning between them. Now that the moment had arrived, couched in terms that he never could have expected, Skopik was filled with a wild, adrenalized bloodlust, and he felt himself grinning a crazy grin. Was he actually enjoying this? Yeah, he thought. Yeah, I guess I am. Drawing on the Force, gathering it inside as he'd been taught during hundreds of hours of training, he jerked the vent fixture from its housing. It came loose with a hollow metallic pop, bolts rattling free, opening a rectangle of cold space that fed into an open air shaft above. Still dangling from the open shaft, Skopik turned the vent fixture over in his free hand, evaluating its immediate utility as a weapon. It was thin and aerodynamic with sharp edges. It would serve the purpose well enough.
He looked down at the thing that had been Jura.
Whatever you are,
Skopeak muttered,
say goodbye to your head.
Swinging himself around, he flung the vent housing as hard as he could at Jura's corpse. The makeshift discus whistled down through the air and found its target perfectly, shearing Jura's head from its shoulders and sending it tumbling forward across the floor. Thick, half-clotted blood spurted from the stump of the corpse's neck. The decapitated body took another shambling step, tilted sideways, and fell to its knees, then down on its belly. Still dangling from the open vent, he was taking no chances. Skopeak stared down at the thing in frank fascination. Nothing he'd learned at the academy even came close to what he was looking at right now. When he told the others... Thumping noises from below. The headless monstrosity was still moving. In fact, it was leaning forward, groping around the floor until it found its severed head, sitting back up again and holding the head face forward in front of its chest, tilting it up in Skopeak's direction so that those runny black eyes were staring straight up at Skopeak, mouth working up and down, as if it were chewing on something. The mouth opened, and it screamed. Skopeak saw the decapitated corpse of Jura Ostrogoth haul back and fling its own head straight at him, its mouth still wide open. Without thinking, the Zabrak swung his free hand in front of his face and felt teeth clamp into the tender flesh of his forearm, ripping through the skin and muscle right down to the bone. The pain was unbelievable, chemical somehow, as if the incisors were coated in some kind of fast-acting acid. Agony shot up through Skopeak's arm to his clavicle, and he let go of the vent and fell, the head still affixed to his arm, and hit the floor hard. Blurrily, he looked down at the head. It was making little gurgling sounds now, its jaw tightening and releasing, the eyes still gleaming.
Get off me!
Skopeak shouted, trying to shake his arm, but unable to muster much strength. Was the arm broken?
Get off!
He grabbed a hank of the thing's hair and pulled as hard as he could, but it still wouldn't release.
Get off my arm!
For several horrible seconds, he tried slamming it against the floor, pounding it as hard as he could, but nothing seemed to affect it. It was locked on tight, the burning liquid pain continuing to drip through the wound in his forearm. Skopeak stood up. The floor felt crooked under his feet. Staggering toward the bed, he underestimated the distance and crashed to the floor a second time, this time landing on his face. Blackness was crowding up through his vision, eclipsing the light. And he realized now that the pain in his arm had basically stopped, overwhelmed by a cool numbness that had begun spreading through his entire body. Skopeak fell utterly still. All sound faded. The numb feeling deepened, bringing with it a kind of near euphoria that swept through his consciousness in one solid black wave. "This isn't so bad," was his final fleeting thought.